Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I'm here to help you make peace with food and lose weight without dieting. That means no more counting calories or carbs, no more thinking about food all the time. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health all without ever going on another diet. If you would like to join me today and tell me what's on your mind, anything to do with food, weight, body image, or anything that's eating at you, since often we turn to food to avoid what is bothering us or to cope. So if something is eating at you, if something is bothering you, doesn't even have to do with food, give me a call and let's see if we can lift the burden. 818-602-4929 is the number here in the studio. Okay, here's an email I got from someone who wants to be known as Anonymous. And Anonymous writes, "Loved this week's program." Thank you, Anonymous. That always makes me happy. Anonymous is referring to the show I did on food guilt and how not to feel guilty about what you eat. He or she goes on to say, question, can this philosophy be applied to alcohol? That's part of my binging. 2 or 3 drinks a night, definitely using it to distract from real problems. That is a great question from Anonymous. And yes, the same principle applies to alcohol as to food. In fact, I thought that you might be interested in a book that my colleague Lance Dodas wrote, and it's called Breaking Addiction. And his research and his practical strategies are very helpful, so helpful that I thought it would be good to share an example from his book. It's called Breaking Addiction, a 7-Step Handbook for Ending Any Addiction. And by the way, when I make a comparison between drinking alcohol and eating, I am not connecting alcoholism to overeating or binge eating. The point is that both are coping strategies, as you will see by this example. So, okay, this is Dr. Lance Dodas talking about his patient, Dr. Luke Green. So Dr. Luke Green trudged into his office in the radiology department of his hospital. Life was really depressing, and always had been. He had started drinking heavily as a radiology resident just out of medical school, and now at 40 years old, he was drinking every night. Again, as I read this, think about replacing eating for drinking. Remember, both are coping strategies. Okay, so Luke worked hard. He had always worked hard, and his current position as assistant chief of his hospital department spoke to that. As depressed as he always felt, though, Luke did not like to turn to others for help because he always felt he could and should manage things on his own. Oh, let me just take a moment and say, I hear this all the time. There's some resistance to the idea of asking for help, to depending on other people, to needing anything from other people. And the reality is, we all need each other. Some people are overly independent. Luke would be one of them. And some people may be overly dependent. My mother-in-law, I'm just saying. Maybe you didn't hear that. So ideally, it's interdependence that we're looking for, right? To be both independent, but to also rely on and lean on and need and want other people. And when you can't do that, it becomes problematic. Remember, in our psyches, food represents people. Food represents nurturing and mothering and connection and love. Okay, so one day, his department chief called him in to say the chief had to take a leave of absence, and he wanted Luke to be the acting chair of the department. When Luke left the chief's office, he had a strange mix of feelings. This was certainly good news, but Luke felt the old depressive feelings worsening in him. Did he really deserve this? He'd only been assistant chief for a year and a half. By the time Luke returned to his own office, he began to think about having a drink. Remember, he could just as easily have begun to think about eating pizza or snacks. And this made no sense to him at all. He had been abstinent at that point for nearly a month, and he thought he was finally past drinking. Oh, doesn't this sound familiar to those of you who have been dieting? You know, you're like, oh, I'm finally past that food thing. I've beaten it. I've lost weight, or I've been on this diet. And then suddenly, randomly, it just comes back. So why would Luke think about drinking now? This promotion was very good news. But after work, Luke stopped at a liquor store, brought home a bottle of whiskey, and began drinking the second he walked through the door. Now, some background. Luke was the third child in his family, and before he was born, his father lost his longtime job at a shoe manufacturing plant, and the family struggled after that. They moved twice when Luke's dad found work in other cities in the state, and they went into serious debt. And for a few months, they relied on what was then the new food stamp program to provide for their two small children. And then just before Luke was born, his father landed a good job in a growing company. And by the time Luke was 3.5 years old, they were all back on their feet. So Luke never remembered the hardships his family had suffered, since he'd been too young to experience the early struggles of the family. But his family remembered, and though his parents had no intention of hurting Luke, he often heard from them about what they'd all been through and how grateful he should be for having escaped those rough times. Now, his siblings were more direct. Both of them saw him as unfairly lucky, and they never let him forget that he was the spoiled one. He never had to go through any hard times. Luke got this message loud and clear. Over the years, his response was to work hard at school or work hard at chores around the house to show that he did appreciate how fortunate he was. He became a serious child, not smiling much. Outside the family, he earned admiration from his teachers and coaches for his dedication and perseverance. But strangely, to those around him, he never seemed to derive much pleasure from the honors he received. When he began drinking as a radiology resident, it was a welcome relief. He felt like a burden was lifted. And it was no wonder that it took him so many years to decide that drinking was a bad idea for him, because it did so much for him. So drinking, like eating, again, not making a direct comparison, is a frenemy. It does something for you. It helps you in some way. And that is what needs to be discovered. It helps you, but it also hurts you. So the day after he finished off half the whiskey bottle he'd bought at the liquor store, Luke woke up feeling terrible. He wondered, why would he drink now? Like so much of the rest of his emotional life, this just didn't make sense to him. Okay, so then Dr. Lance Dodas asks readers some questions. First, he asks, what are the underlying emotional themes that lead to the experience of helplessness, and in turn, its addictive solution? And so for those of you listening, anonymous, both eating and drinking are your addictive solution. For some, it's just eating. For some, maybe it's just drinking. For some, it's both or other things. Second, he asks, what defenses does Luke use that keep him from seeing the key moment? And remember, defenses are like protective mechanisms. What is the key moment on his path to addiction? And last, what more direct alternative actions could he have taken in place of drinking? So here are some of the answers. And remember, we could easily substitute food for alcohol in all of this, eating for drinking in all of this. So what are the underlying emotional themes that led to Luke's experience of helplessness and in turn to the addictive solution of drinking? So Luke grew up with the sense that he did not deserve what was given to him. Sadly, although his parents had worked hard to provide a better life for him, their repeated message that he had a better deal than the rest of the family actually made his life much worse. And he grew up with the burden of unworthiness from which there seemed to be no way out. And he carried this guilt, the weight of this guilt with him into adulthood, as if he was somehow responsible. He'd gotten some special pass and felt guilty that everyone else had suffered and he had not. So drinking was a solution to his lifelong trapped feelings of unworthiness and guilt. In this trap, it had never mattered how hard he worked or how many honors he received, because he believed he did not deserve them. When he drank, first he finally gave something to himself, and then drinking also reversed the sense of helplessness, right? There was nothing that he could do about his circumstances. He was helpless to change the past. But drinking was an action that he could actually take. And that's why it was very powerful. So the key moment, what was the key moment on Luke's path to addiction? The key moment was when he went back to his office after speaking with the chief. And that's when the thought of drinking first entered his mind. And though he subsequently worked all day, he didn't start drinking until he arrived home. And by the way, this is something that I hear a lot with my patients, my clients, with people in my online program, is sometimes just, oop, I will hold that thought. We have a caller. Hi, caller, you're on with Dr. Nina.
Hi, Dr. Nina. This is Carrie. Hi. And I'm calling in. I wanted to find out what's eating at me.
Wonderful. I didn't catch your name because you got a little bit cut off.
Carrie.
Welcome, Carrie. What's eating at you? What is eating at you?
I have this situation where my husband and I have this situation where there's my mother-in-law's best friend's daughter. She is just has something against me. I mean, I just can't figure it out for the life of me. We've been married a long time and she's never, we'll be at parties together and she won't even like say hello to me, and she just like snubs me every time she sees me. And I just can't figure out, I mean, after all these years, I mean, she's married and got children and I'm married and have children, and for some reason this girl just has something, she just dislikes me for some reason. I just don't know why. And it's so hard to go to any functions, you know, where I know she's going to be at. And, you know, it's really uncomfortable.
Well, that sounds like a very upsetting, uncomfortable, and unfair situation. It's sort of horrible when people apparently for no discernible reason take a dislike to you and snub you and treat you terribly. And it you know, I was just talking about helplessness with the example of Luke, and I guess this is also a sense of helplessness you feel, like you don't know why it's happening, it doesn't come from any place, it's not like something happened between you. So what I find is that when people treat other people like this, often, if there's no discernible reason, often it has to do with envy. Now, let me just take a moment to explain the difference between jealousy and envy. Jealousy is when, you know, your best friend gets a great new promotion and you're like, oh, I wish I had a great new promotion and more money and all that stuff. And you're like, oh, good for her. I wish I had that too. That's jealousy. Envy is when you're angry at the person who got it and you want to destroy them. So anger, envy would sound like, oh, she got a new promotion and I hate her for getting that new promotion. I'm going to treat her horribly because I want to punish her for having something good. So
right.
Is there anything that you can think of in terms of your circumstances? And let me get this right. This is the mother-in-law's best friend's daughter.
Correct.
Is there anything in your life circumstances that she would perhaps feel envious of you, going back to when you first met her?
Well, the only thing I can think of is that she's like not very, like she's really overweight, and she looks kind of like one of those dolls, like a troll.
She looks like a troll? Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, so she is overweight and looks like a troll. Carrie, are you how what are you like and look like in comparison? Be honest.
Well, I just recently, like over the last year or so, lost, you know, quite a bit of weight, and I'm not to sound like I'm, you know, really like think I'm so great, but I, you know, I exercise all the time, and you know, I take pretty good care of, you know, my physical. You know, like I'm in good shape. Like I run a lot, and you
okay.
know, I'm pretty comfortable with, you know, like the shape I'm in now. But I've worked, you know, really hard at it. It wasn't always like this. So, I mean, I'm in good shape, and I'm lost a lot of weight. So, I mean, that's all I can really say, you know, about myself.
Well, and do you look like a troll?
No, I don't think I do.
Would you describe yourself as attractive?
I guess maybe sometimes.
Okay. So, this woman is not attractive, and even if she lost weight, she may still look like a troll. Would you say she's one of those kind of people? Right?
Yeah, right. Pretty much.
All right. Mm-hmm. And you are attractive, and sometimes the envy of that is just it's so unbearable for people. If you feel and you're the woman and you feel ugly, and here comes Carrie looking all attractive, and maybe she hates you for that. I mean,
I
don't know, but almost 100% of the time, I guess that almost 100% would be like 99% of the time, envy is at the basis for these kinds of inexplicable types of mean, nasty, when nothing's happened, right? Nothing's happened to explain it. Envy is at the root of this. And so there's nothing you can do. All you can do is realize that this woman is taking out some hatred, some self-loathing directed at you, and to know that it's not really about you.
Right.
And then I've got
my mother-in-law that makes it a lot worse, because she goes around and acts like she doesn't notice anything and just like has her head in the sand and like will still continue to, you know, like act like everything's just fine, like have gatherings and expect us to both, you know, attend them and talk highly about this person, you know, and you know, she just goes around and makes everything, you know, nice, like everything's fine, like she doesn't know what I'm talking about.
So is there anything familiar about that, like denial of reality that precedes your mother-in-law? And not treating you fairly?
Yeah, I think she goes around. I think she's in denial.
No, I mean, in your life, has anyone else kind of treated you unfairly or ignored the fact that someone was treating you badly? Or have you ever felt like things were unequal?
Not really that I can recall.
Okay, so this is just specifically this situation, which has been, sounds like a number of years, in which mother-in-law denies reality because she doesn't want to upset her best friend, and there's this pretense that everything is how it is not.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty galling when that happens. So you're not going to be able to change your mother-in-law, unfortunately. You're not going to be able to change the the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing you can do is change how you respond to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you respond? Like, what's the last interaction?
Well, the last interaction was we were at the best friend just recently passed away, and I showed up to the funeral out of respect to my mother and father-in-law. And I forced myself to tell the person that doesn't like me that I was sorry about her mom. And she turned around in front of a bunch of people and told me that I was a bitch.
Mm.
So yeah. From now on, I'm just staying away from any events that she attends. I don't need to be treated like that, humiliated. And I haven't spoken to my mother-in-law since it happened. And I don't really plan on speaking to her anytime soon.
Well, that just sounds like a horrible situation, and I can understand how mortifying it was, but it seems like she showed herself by calling you a bitch. It sure sounds like she showed something about herself when you were just being respectful. So to recognize, validate, yes, this is absolutely crazy and unreasonable, and it's hurtful and it's painful. Because it just is. Whatever the underlying reason for why she's doing this, it's painful and it's upsetting. It makes you mad and it maybe makes you sad. And just and then I think that what you're doing is, look, this is not your sister. This is not your cousin. You know, there is no reason for this person to be, you know, have interaction with this person. Just to protect yourself from someone like that and know that when she makes these kinds of comments, it reflects on her and not on you.
Right. That makes sense. So,
yeah.
Right. So that really helps me, you know, look at this in a better light, you know.
Yeah, it's sort of pathetic that she would do that at her mother's funeral. I mean, that's horrible.
I know. I just was blown away that somebody would do that, you know, at their own mother's funeral. It really, like you said, says something about her. So,
yes, and you know what? If your mother-in-law ever says something, one thing you can do is say something to your mother-in-law, and if you want to, it might not do any good, but at some point. You use my SET approach, which is the situation, emotion, and the translation, which is really the meaning. So you say, hey mother-in-law, you know, when you pretend that so-and-so, that everything is fine with so-and-so, when she is openly attacking me and calling me names in public at a funeral, when all I did was say, I'm sorry about your loss, it makes me feel, so that's the situation, that's S, it makes me feel, and this is the emotion, hurt, upset, what you fill in the E's. How does it make you feel?
Right.
What else, Carrie, what else does it make you feel other than hurt and upset?
Just, I don't ever want to see her again.
Really protective of yourself, because it means, and this is actually the most important part, the fact that she didn't protect you, pretends like everything's fine, seems to choose the mean woman over you. What does it mean?
That's the part I'm trying to figure out. That's the part I can't fathom. That she's been doing this for years, chooses her over me.
So it means... it means that she's more important than you are. It means that you're not like a daughter to her. It means, like, you know, something along those lines. And that's maybe for you to figure out a little bit more which of those is the strongest one. But that's one thing you can do. Now, if you do that, just go in with the hope that you're going to say something for you. the chances of your mother-in-law going, oh my gosh, I'm enlightened, I've been horrible, I'm going to change my ways immediately, are pretty much slim to nothing. But sometimes it works, and most of all, it can feel good to speak up for yourself.
Right. I will try that.
Okay.
I have to see her again or talk to her on the phone, but right now I don't have any plans to do any of that, so I've got a lot of time to figure out what I'm going to do.
Well, just take care of yourself and protect yourself from some, you know, sometimes we have to protect ourselves from the people that should be most there for us. But I'm sure, I hope that knowing why this person, it's not like she saw something in you that's bad and she's just treating you badly. That this is clearly envy. It always is. I hate to say always, because there is sometimes, you know, that 1%, but sounds very clear that that's what it is. And that's, you know, it's sad for her and for you. Well, let us know the update.
I will. And I want to thank you for, you know, helping me out today. I'm really going to think about this conversation, and I'll be calling you back to let you know what the update is.
Wonderful, Carrie. I can't wait to hear it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Dr. Nina.
Bye. Oh, yeah, so often, you know, what's eating at us are things like this. Something's going on it's easier to focus on your weight and what you're eating than, you know, this situation in which you feel so helpless and it doesn't make any sense. And that actually leads me back to Luke and his drinking when he got this promotion, temporary promotion or whatever, that how he went to drink. And he, thinking about drinking was the first thing he did. And I hear this a lot with people thinking about eating. They start planning their binges. They start planning what they're going to eat. And just the planning part of it helps to alleviate the whatever it is that they're feeling. So now Dr. Doda says, well, what defenses kept Luke from seeing the key moment in which he was going to turn to alcohol? And remember, defenses are protections. So he says that for all his high intelligence, Luke was not very introspective. When he was depressed, he just worked harder, just as he had done as a child. So outside his awareness, so unconsciously, he thought if he worked hard enough, maybe he could finally prove that he was worthy of what he'd been given in life and rid himself of the guilt. Besides his compulsive working, Luke had another defense. He avoided relying on other people. And in refusing outside help, he was again trying to avoid feeling guilty for expecting to be given even more from others. With these defenses in place, he never considered the underlying issues, the underlying conflicts that his addiction to alcohol actually served as a solution to. What more direct actions could he have taken in place of drinking? Well, what was important here was not the fact of being offered the promotion, but what it meant to him. Just as when I was just talking to Carrie, what it meant to her that her mother-in-law pretended that, you know, everything was fine when clearly she was being treated badly by this best friend's daughter. The meaning is always the most important, and often that meaning is what we're not aware of. So the best thing Luke could have done was to focus on the meaning, but he had never thought about his life in psychological terms. If he had, he could have seen that the promotion felt like an honor, and remembered that he never felt worthy of such things. And in looking at the meaning of the event, rather than the event itself, he had a chance not to be overwhelmed by these mixed feelings. He could have, if he had been reflective, he could have said, oh, you know what, as a kid, I really felt like the good things that I had, I felt guilty about them because my siblings and my parents, they didn't have it so good, And now I'm feeling a revival of those feelings, but I'm feeling the feelings of the past in the present. And I need to maybe look at it a different way. And there were also some practical actions he could have taken. He could have called the chief and said he needed a few days to think it over. He could have turned to other people to talk it over. And of course, doing that would have run into his need to do everything for himself. And he avoided seeking help. So as Luke began to understand what was happening emotionally inside of him, he was able to use his urge to drink as a signal to pay attention to the underlying themes that ran through his life. So if you suddenly feel like eating, it is not because you are addicted to food. It is because you are possibly, we'll use the term addiction, addicted to eating as a way of coping with something that's going on. When you're turning to food in this way, you are turning away from something else. So by seeing how his emotional helplessness created these urges to drink, he could stop. He could use the feelings to understand, the feelings of wanting to drink, to understand how these feelings influenced his life, these feelings of thoughts about himself. And then he could master those addictive urges when they arose. And that's very similar to eating, right? When you find yourself suddenly thinking about pizza or cake or whatever, you know, think about what's going on in that moment. If you were not to think about food, what would be on your mind? What would you be thinking about in that moment? So for Luke, it would be, you know, thinking about his guilt over anything good and the sense that of unworthiness, that he didn't deserve it. And if he had just recognized that at the moment, then that would have quelled his impulses to drink. If this was food instead of alcohol, and he was like, oh, I'm going to go to In-N-Out on the way home, he might have thought, oh, wait a minute. What is, you know, I'm trying to undo something. I'm trying to resolve something. What's eating at me? What am I feeling? And what am I thinking? And when you do that, and you recognize what it is, then you can directly respond to that. So, by the way, again, this is from the book Breaking Addiction, a 7-step handbook for ending any addiction by distinguished psychiatrist and my colleague, Dr. Lance Dodes, who has successfully helped people master all kinds of isms, alcoholism, compulsive gambling, smoking, sex addiction. And this is, you know, what people call a radical approach, but it's really psychoanalytically informed, that there's something going on in our unconscious. He specifically points to helplessness as a major trigger, that and says that all addictions have at their heart unrecognized emotional factors that explain why you feel the impulse to eat or do or whatever it is, and you know, why we feel that impulse when we do. And again, it has to do with powerlessness and helplessness. So helplessness, oh, by the way, if anyone else would like to call in, I would love to hear from you. The number here at the studio is 818-602-4929. 818-602-4929. So back to helplessness. It is a feeling that most people cannot stand to experience, either on its own or because it intensifies other painful or upsetting feelings. Like Carrie, part of the problem, you could just feel it, was not only was she being treated badly, inexplicably, but she was helpless to change. Everyone was acting like nothing was wrong, and she feels helpless to change anything, to wake people up, to make them realize, hey, something's wrong here. And so what is helplessness? It is defined as, one, being unable to help oneself. Two, weak or dependent. 3, deprived of strength or power. 4, incapacitated. The state of helplessness is connected to vulnerability and dependency, both of which can be extremely uncomfortable. Now, how do people deal with helplessness and powerlessness? Well, anger, productivity, meaning workaholism, withdrawal, depression, and or denial are ways of distracting from that intolerable state of helplessness. And so, by the way, is binging or even thinking about food, focusing on food. Binging is a way of distracting yourself from helplessness and powerlessness because it is an action. Powerlessness is you can't do anything. You're just a victim of circumstance. You're helpless. But eating is an action, and it in itself, even though it can feel out of control, it's something that you're doing, and on some level that is like an answer to the helplessness. But let's look at all of those. So anger is an active emotion, whereas helplessness is a passive emotion. So you may get angry at yourself for eating. You may get mad at yourself for what you weigh. You may be upset with yourself for what you're eating in that moment. You may be upset with the amount. You may be upset that you chose this and not that. Anger at yourself, your food, your weight, anything like that, can be a way of avoiding helplessness over some other area in your life. Maybe, you know, someone got a promotion and you didn't, and there's nothing you can do about it, and it sucks. And rather than process that anger, lots of people deny their feelings, right? Because we live in a society that says, oh, don't feel your feelings. So people say things like, oh, no, I'm just so happy for that person that got promoted over me. I'm really, really so happy for them. Yes, I really am. Denying their rage and then, you know, turning it against themselves. Okay, what's another one? Productivity. Being busy is another way of turning passive to active. Focusing on achievements, being a slave driver to yourself. Those are all strategies to distract from helplessness. Now, that includes thinking about food, weight, and calories. That's an example of focusing on doing, you know, what are you eating, how much, why, rather than feeling. Withdrawal is a way of denying helplessness. I find that with anorexia, it's often a withdrawal from everything, food, wants, needs, and usually people. Avoiding people and having a relationship with food and your body instead is another form of withdrawal, as is depression. A lot of people stop eating when they're depressed. A lot of people eat when they're depressed. So it's all a way of withdrawing from what's going on and just distracting yourself. Last is denial. If you tell yourself that what makes you feel helpless isn't a big deal, that doesn't bother me. That's okay. I'm not bothered by that. You may be denying your true feelings in order to minimize the reality, the painful reality of the situation. That's a way of dismissing your feelings. So, by the way, another way of dismissing your feelings is to look on the bright side. I'm all for positive thinking. What is the saying? No one ever hurt their eyesight by looking on the bright side. Something like that. I totally butchered that quote, but nothing wrong with looking on the bright side. But recognize that not everything is bright. Not everything is positive. And often positive thinking is a way of denouncing or denying something that's painful or upsetting. You know, so the way to get rid of what many people call negative emotions, painful or upsetting emotions, or anger, helplessness, pain, is actually to feel it, as yucky as that is. That's the way you get rid of feelings, by saying, oh, I shouldn't really feel that way because of this. You know, okay, so I back to the promotion thing. I don't know why that's a theme today, but you know, I didn't get that promotion, but that's okay. Like, I probably wouldn't have even wanted it. It would have been too stressful. Actually, I'll have more time to do yoga after work. Okay. Yes, that's all true. But get to that after you say, oh, I'm so bummed. Why didn't they pick me? What's wrong with me? Is there something wrong with me? I didn't get picked. Why I feel so terrible about this? And really process it and then go through it. What is it? The only way out is through. So first you recognize that you're feeling something painful, and then you say, but bright side, more yoga after work. And that is looking in the positive without denying the pain. So, okay, what do you do with all this information about helplessness? Consider this. If you weren't feeling helpless over food, what would you feel helpless about? If you weren't focused on being powerful over food, being powerful over your diet plan or whatever, telling yourself you're only going to eat clean, you're only going to eat keto, you're only going to eat paleo, you're only going to eat this, you're only going to eat that, you're going to, et cetera, you get the idea. If you weren't focused on that, there's probably something else you'd be focusing on, or something else you'd be feeling helpless about. So, if you weren't trying to control food, what or who would you be trying to control? This is all food for thought. I'd love to hear your thoughts, so please call in with your questions or comments about anything to do with this topic or anything else that's on your mind. Again, the number at the studio is 818-602-4929. Okay, so back to emails from listeners. So someone else named Kay emailed to say she really liked the distinction between guilt and shame that I shared a couple weeks ago. And she asked if I'd share some more thoughts about food guilt. Since I gave a lot of my thoughts already, and if you missed the episode, you can listen in on the LA Talk Radio archives or on iTunes. It's the April 18th, 2018 episode. So since I already shared a lot of my own thoughts, I thought I'd share some thoughts of other people about this topic. So here's some thoughts by author Virginia Soul Smith. And her article is titled, How to Stop Beating Yourself Up About What You Eat. Perfect, right? I mean, what a perfect title to an article. Okay, so this is Virginia Soul Smith writing. I'm speaking her words. She says, location, my house, girls' night, the scene, cheese plate, many bottles of wine, and a running commentary from all my friends. I can't stop eating this cheese. I can't believe I'm still eating this cheese. I've been eating so much cheese this week. I am so gross. To me, I'm so sorry I'm eating all your cheese. And then, do you have any more of this cheese? Of course, it's not always cheese. Feel free to insert bread, pasta, cookies, chocolate, or chips into that scenario. In this age of clean eating, detox diets, and food phobias, there's an increasingly long list of foods that health-conscious women and men feel terrible about eating. If we eat them in private, we carry that shame around inside us. Or maybe text a friend the picture of the crumb-covered aftermath, asking for absolution. If we eat them in public, an apology accompanies every bite, as if we can indulge only through a kind of preemptive atonement. But why do we feel so guilty? Or at least, why do we think we should feel guilty about the simple act of eating food and daring to enjoy it? She says, why we food shame. And for her, she says, for years, the foods that most inspired this kind of guilt were baked goods, specifically brownies. She loves brownies, but she rarely let them in her house because when she did, the pan wouldn't last more than a day. If she encountered them at a party, they would dominate her whole night. Why, what should I eat before I let myself have a brownie? Can I have a second one? Maybe just this broken piece? Why is no one else at this party eating the brownies? And underneath all these thoughts were another, even more insidious undercurrent. She was sure that she was abnormally obsessed with brownies because she was fat, possibly the fattest person in the room, and getting fatter with every bite. She quotes Glenys Oyston, a Los Angeles-based dietitian and founder of Dare to Not Diet, who says, as a culture, we've fully bought into this myth that if we eat the right food in the right amounts, we will achieve the ideal body shape. The flip side is that eating any wrong food isn't merely unhealthy. It's considered a huge failure of willpower. When we categorize foods as good or bad, we're actually categorizing ourselves as good or bad, strong or weak, worthy or unworthy. Our ability to resist forbidden foods isn't a moral failing. It's how we're wired. Our brains react really strongly to restriction, says Marcy Evans, who's a dietitian in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She says, the more we say no bad about a food, the more we can't stop thinking about it. And lately, our catalog of bad food has been getting bigger and bitter. Gluten, bad. Red meat, bad. Anything in a package, bad. Until we're apologizing for eating at all. This kind of thing happens even if your reasons to avoid certain foods have more to do with health than weight. And she goes on to talk about an example of someone, but I'm going to skip over and say how to break the habit. Here's what she says. Most of us are not going to stop eating cheese or brownies, nor should we. Feeding your body what it wants and needs instead of restricting yourself is associated with lower rates of disordered eating, depression, and other mental health issues. The trick is to figure out how to end the apology cycle. And one of the things that I talk about a lot, by the way, is that the anticipation of deprivation always makes you want it more. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, well, I'm never going to have pizza until I lose that 20, 30, 50, 100 pounds. I'm never going to eat pizza again in my life. So I'm going to have a whole pizza tonight. Like you can bank pizza. This idea of I can't have it, so I might as well have it now. Or I had a piece, so my day is ruined. I might as well have the whole thing. So what Virginia did was she stopped apologizing, criticizing, or justifying what she was eating completely. And she said one cool thing about apologizing less out loud is that over time, she found her internal monologue quieted down as well. The brownies are just brownies now. I can eat them, I can love them, I can have fun at a party all at the same time, she says. And she's also aware of how much she hears other people food shaming themselves. As you work to let go of food shame, you may also find yourself eating more intuitively. And what does that mean? That means choosing foods in response to your body's needs and wants instead of what your head is telling you that you can or cannot have. So here are her suggestions. One, avoid nutritional mandates. We rely too much on our brains to tell us how to eat. Getting caught up in the number of calories or whether it's a good or bad food can keep you stuck. Instead, check in with your body. After you eat a meal or a snack, ask, how am I feeling physically? Would I like to feel this way again? And then listen with curiosity and without judgment. That is so close to one of my favorite phrases. In fact, someone had a hat made and gave it to me last holidays, and it says, be curious, not critical. One of my favorite expressions ever. Two, honor your hunger. Even if that means you eat lunch at 11 o'clock in the morning or have a second or third helping, reliably eating until you feel satiated teaches your body and brain to trust each other, which will help you feel more relaxed and in charge of your eating. Three, let your weight work itself out. Once you stop food shaming, you may find yourself eating more and maybe, not always, maybe gaining some weight, but on the other hand, many people, by the way, if you gain weight, it's only temporary. On the other hand, many people find they lose weight in this process because guilt was leading them to overindulge in forbidden foods. Either way, your weight will stabilize over time at the right weight for you. Remember that dieting or food shaming doesn't work because it focuses on what you're eating and not why. If you're turning to food, you're turning away from something else. When you identify that and you respond directly, you stop eating for comfort or distraction. That's how you make peace with food. That's how you win the diet war. And that is our show for today. Thank you so much for being here. I am here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio, where I help you create a healthier, happier relationship to food and yourself. Listen live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. or listen online on iTunes. Just do a search for The Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. And if you like the show, please be sure to leave a rating or review. I would appreciate it so much. Thank you and have a great week. Stay curious, not critical.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.